Welcome to episode 76 of the Get Cyber Resilient Show. I'm Dan McDermott and I'll be your host today. This week is our In the News episode and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity experts Bradley Singh and Garrett O'Hara. And we will start with the confirmation from the interactive live streaming provider Twitch that it has been hacked and its source code and secrets have leaked out. We will review the latest attack on our healthcare system with the hack of Macquarie Health Corporation. We'll look at the latest announcement from New South Wales Government about extending the use of DMARC for all councils and LGAs. And finally, we'll take a deep dive into the federal government's ransomware action plan. Now, Brad, before we dive into the cyber issues this week, can you help me and some of our listeners understand what is Twitch?
Certainly. What is Twitch? That's a great question. Twitch is something which is, I guess, really popped up in popularity over the past 10 years, probably around the advent of things like YouTube and kind of that whole people making content themselves. Probably since around 2008, I think we really started to see the rise and surge of it, alongside things like social media, of course, as well. What it is, though, effectively, it's a platform where either anybody or a media organization, a lot of real life stuff these days is too, where people are just doing things like cooking food, or it could be like live music as an example. Like, it's not just video game anymore, but effectively it's a community where people can stream themselves and then also make revenue or have sponsorships and ads around it. Now, in terms of what we've seen recently, though, is potentially the one of the largest data breaches on the platform, where we've seen a lot of the creators on the platform, a lot of the individuals involved have had their personal details leaked, but also the dollar values that Amazon, aka Twitch, is purchasing as well. Is kind of paying towards them. So I think there's, it's quite an interesting one in terms of, I guess, this from a sense of becoming a popular media, but also now a whole lot of details which have been breached and potentially more as well. From what I understand, it was effectively uploaded as a torrent online, about 120 GB.
Yeah, big trove, it seems like. And there's some interesting stuff there around the unreleased Steam competitor. That's not going to be too good for Amazon, given, you know, whatever the privacy side of things, which is pretty serious. But I wonder about the financial implications here. You know, from what I understand, it's the code, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bradley, but if it's the code for a Steam competitor, like, it's not a small thing to be out there in the wild and for hackers to have their hands on. And then the other side of it is, you know, they're reading through it, there's a backlash, or, you know, people are a little bit upset knowing how much money they, are they called Twitchers? Or, you know, that's people who look at birds, right? So, I don't know, whatever they're called.
Streamers? I don't know.
Yeah, streamers.
Content creators.
I'm so out of the loop, man. I saw this pop up on Reddit and I didn't understand any of the things that people were annoyed about. It made no sense to me. So I definitely feel old. But I was looking at some of the backlash and, you know, thinking about the big numbers that are being thrown around, including some of the sort of Melbourne-based streamers from what I understand. You know, we've got some Australians making some mad coin from this. But the other side of it is, you know, if they're making mad money, then presumably Amazon and Twitch is making madder money. And I think that's the sort of interesting part for me, is that how lucrative this stuff actually is. And I know in one of the articles, there was the question, why do people watch other people playing games? And I you know, there was an explanation, but I'll be honest, as a 46-year-old, it made no sense to me.
No, all I can think is that it's another thing that my kids will put down as a career ambition. And it's like, nice. Being a Twitcher is not a career. But anyway.
It's true, actually. Like, I don't know if we've covered this already, but they surveyed kids in America and they said that back in the day, everyone wanted to be an astronaut or wanted to be, you know, something like that. But I think now kids want to be TikTokers, I think was the number one. The number one thing kids wanted TikToker. To be.
It's interesting that, like, so much data got released as well. Like, do we understand, like why would somebody release it all in one go? Like, what's the motives behind this? What's sort of, you know, happening in the background here that is driving, you know, breach is one thing, but then it's like then sort of dumping it out there as well. What's sort of going on in that space?
One of the things I think we've seen with this community, it's kind of almost grown up over the past 10 years, but it is full of a lot of, you could say, toxic behavior, a lot of doxing, a lot of harassment, a lot of people potentially getting rubbed the wrong way. It seems like this is, I don't want to say Robin Hood-esque, but it feels like somebody has purposely leaked only part of it, and really highlighting how much people get paid in terms of money. I think Gar made an interesting point there in terms of the reality of how much of it, how much money is involved, right? So from a competitiveness perspective, some of Amazon's internal tools, their intellectual property, the whole platform economy, we're kind of almost seeing a bit of an arms race from different companies, Microsoft included, which are trying to go into that whole ecosystem and make money of it. In fact, I think Microsoft had a live streaming service, spent millions on it, and then kind of got nowhere with it.
Didn't they try and like poach one of the guys that was on Twitch for millions and millions, millions of dollars to try and get him to go across?
He did. So it was a guy called Ice Poseidon, and he got banned off Twitch because he was entering an aeroplane. He was live streaming himself, and somebody called the FBI, and they swatted the aeroplane on live on Twitch. And so because of that, he got banned off Twitch, and then I think Microsoft paid him a couple mil to go over there.
Full on. And like, do you sort of see this as a version of the gig economy? Because it was kind of, you know, when you're doing the research for this, I mean, it's basically people kind of hustling to make some money doing streaming, you know, for whatever, I think you said baking, and there's some Dungeons and Dragons stuff on there.
Like whittling and stuff like that, like any kind of life skills. Like, I don't think it's just video games. It's just a format, right?
Yeah, but it's that thing where it's grown into a platform where it sounds like some people are using it as their kind of income source. And, you know, having read, kind of try to educate myself on the world of Twitch before we had this conversation, you know, it sounds like some people are sort of irked and had a day where they didn't stream or Twitch or whatever the verb that we're supposed to use is. You know, almost like it seems like kind of collective bargaining by the gig economists or economists, gig economy workers on Twitch. So you kind of wonder, is there some of that kind of activist stuff in the background where, you know, is that a motivation here to release so much data?
It definitely sounds like some sort of hacktivism, right? Like that somebody's, you know, is got their back up about something. They're not agreeing with, you know, some sort of principle, and there's like, you know, a bit of a one-upmanship is what it seems like.
Yeah, because there's no ransom demands. There was none of that, right? It was basically, you know, it went from nothing to data exposed. So you got to assume that the motivation there is to your point, Dan, it's activism rather than financial.
In terms of the technical aspect, though, real quick as well, from what I understand, it was kind of interesting because I remember when the news broke, it seemed like it was like an active attack on the platform. Twitch told everyone to reset their passwords and stream keys as well, because if you have somebody else's stream key, you theoretically broadcast to anybody else's channel. So you could broadcast to a channel which has, I don't know, 200,000 people watching it, and you could put your face up there or something nasty instead. So a lot of people say, yeah, so there was a huge process, but it looks like it was misconfiguration on Twitch's end. So obviously there's somebody out there who's, you know, downloaded the information, but another misconfigured massive cloud platform putting a user data at risk.
Well, Brad, you certainly seem to know a lot more about Twitch than Gar and I, but and I think like it's obviously it does highlight the vulnerabilities of these large scale platforms as well. Like as well as they're locked down at times, it's the scale that when something does happen, how quickly that can proliferate and the number of sort of people that it can impact. But moving to our next story, which, you know, is a much more somber one and one that gets close to home. And a constant theme, unfortunately, throughout sort of us delivering the show and during the health pandemic has been the notion of cyber attacks on our healthcare sector and the fact that healthcare continues to be one of the highest targeted areas. And we know some of the reasons around the value of the data that's considered to be there and that, but the fact that this continues to happen at this time when we know the crisis and the strain that the system is under at the moment is sort of just mind-boggling that it continues to occur. But unfortunately, we've got the latest story to report, which is around the Macquarie Health Group hit by a cyber attack, and it's affected sort of 6,700 people across multiple hospitals. Brad, what can you tell us has happened here?
Yeah, certainly, Dan. Look, again, no surprise that, unfortunately, no surprise really that another healthcare provider has been hit and targeted. I was trying to think thematically about this, if there's anything kind of, I guess, almost unique from it. But part of me also wonders, you know, is there an answer to this specifically? But it is that whole problem of ransomware. It is that whole ecosystem. It, you know, it feeds itself and the idea that hospitals are so critical. In terms of this attack itself, so it appears that it was the Hive ransomware, which is something or at least a gang or a group which the FBI has issued alerts out from, I think, as early as kind of early September. So they've been known about all for quite a while, if they've been in the news. They also targeted the Memorial Health System, which you guys may or may not remember that data breach from earlier in the year as well, over in... I'm not sure actually where it was, the Memorial Health System. I just tried to look it up, but there's a lot of hospitals with the name Memorial in it.
The problem is if you Google cyber attack on hospitals, there's literally so many of them now that you're going to struggle to find any specific one. It's a tsunami of this stuff.
Yeah, you're 100% right. But what we can say, though, is about at least about Hive ransomware itself is that it's systematic in the sense that they've been highlighted as being a known ransomware service provider. There was some commentary from some news outlets that they were bragging to a degree as well. So, you know, kind of quite proud of their accomplishments. And you know, this kind of stuff is very common in any community, I guess. But I would also say, unfortunately, Dan, you're right. Like, it's the human toll at the end of the day. I think we've been probably quite lucky still up till now in terms of actual human toll of cyber in Australia when it comes to healthcare providers. But it's only a matter of when I'd argue.
I think that's it, isn't it? It's just it's a when rather than if. And yeah, it's a big, I mean, I feel like every, you know, episode of this and all the other security podcasts and every kind of online media sort of presence when it comes to cyber, it's just ransomware. Time and time and time again, it just feels, yeah, a bit like the worry for me is that, and I think other people, is the fatigue that sits in where you just get so tired of it. And we end up normalizing, like, I'll be honest, you know, when I saw this was going to be one of the stories that we're going to cover today, you know, if you roll back a couple of years, there was probably some sense of not shock, but like, oh no, this is really bad. But like, if you guys can tell me a day where there hasn't been a ransomware attack reported, like, it's starting to feel like this is just normal. And we're all a little bit, maybe like COVID will be, you know, we'll just learn to live with it. You know, we'll try and get immunized, but we'll eventually just kind of end up having to live with ransomware at some level. I mean, hopefully not.
Ransomware normal as well as COVID normal as we go forward.
Yeah, that's it. And keep, you know, 2 meters apart if you're an organization that maybe has that ransomware in the park. Yeah, like there's probably some digital equivalent.
And I guess just interested in the ransomware as a service, just to sort of dive into that. We've explained what that is before and that. So just like, is Hive the ones that actually, you know, create the service and that then others deploy, or are they actually deployed this themselves? Do we know like how that's worked and you know, I guess, you know, if they're the ones developing it, they're probably taking the claim in order to try to, you know, drum up business for others, right?
Yeah, it's like, I honestly don't know exactly where the kill chain starts or like who's involved exactly, but I believe it's quite sophisticated in the sense like the Hive piece of software script or bootkit, whatever it is, it'll create like a nice little fake website for the person so they can go there and pay. It'll show how long till their data is going to be deleted and stuff, like, you know, it's on the web and stuff. Like, it's quite a nice little integrated piece which is then meant to decrypt as well. It's even got like a live chat built in there as well, so it's a proper end-to-end kind of service where the ransomware and then allow you to give them money as well, where it's, I guess, very different from the first hack we covered today, which is the polar opposite of hacking, getting the information, putting it up there, and then not asking for payment.
Yeah, and Hive, I mean, it is affiliate-based, so, you know, it is part of that kind of ransomware as a service play that we're seeing more and more of. It's another real worry, and it's another reason I suspect why the ransomware stuff is proliferating and is so popular, because you don't need to know anything. You know, Phil Clark, who works with this years ago, said you just need a credit card and a grudge. And I really feel like that almost should be on a t-shirt for ransomware at this point. But that's it, right? I mean, you can just go pay an affiliate, a little bit like DarkSide, right? The Colonial Pipeline. It's the same deal. You don't have to be a developer. You don't have to know how to, you know, do anything other than get this stuff out there and then sort of pay your, get your payments through Bitcoin. And even then, they've got sort of brokers for the payment side of things. There's very, very little in the ecosystem of ransomware that's not covered by kind of expert organizations that specialize in payments, specialize in broker access, specialize in customer success and service to make sure you get your Bitcoin payments through. It's incredible to see really an industry, you know, and, you know, I think, Brad, you just said it, it's an end-to-end industry. Like, that's what we have here with ransomware now, because it's so lucrative, it's so easy, it's so hard to police. And, and everyone's kind of getting used to it.
Is there a technical answer long term? And again, I'm no super expert in memory or encryption or anything like that, but I wonder, is there a future technical solution in the way that data is stored, or we've encrypted ourselves within our organizations, which potentially inhibits ransomware? Or is it just something which is going to happen forever, and it comes back down to resilience? And do we get to a point where, you know, we can restore systems almost instantly and get back up online straight away?
Yeah, they're. I think it's been around for a little while. Actually, there's these flattened pieces of carbon. They're white, and you can write things on them with pens and pencils, and you can lock those in metal cabinets. And it's old technology, but it works. I don't know, honestly, Brad. I think, you know, there's probably technical things you can do to, you know, potentially get yourself set up to not be vulnerable to this. But I would say it comes back to the productivity versus security argument that we've had for decades, which is, look, you can be totally secure, but nobody can do anything. And then what's the point? And also the fact that everybody is so digitally interdependent, like you could probably lock yourself down to the point where your risk of ransomware is really minimal, but your ability to interact with other organizations easily would probably be cost prohibitive. You know, you would have to do things in ways that just take longer or are frustrating for employees, et cetera, et cetera. I would say, not to downplay like the problem of ransomware, but I think what we've seen consistently is that sometimes the solutions aren't crazy esoteric bleeding edge solutions. They're actually just do really good backups, do them regularly. You know, do application whitelisting, do some basics, assuming you're set up for that and you can. I actually saw a quote, and I wish I'd remembered where I saw it from. Oh, it was in a security white paper this week, but the quote was from somebody, I think, in the US government around what's the one thing that would protect organizations against ransomware. And the comment was something like, get onto Windows 10. And it's not that Windows 10 is particularly secure, but often the problem is people are running, you know, Windows 8.1, or they're sitting on legacy operating systems that aren't getting patched, don't have security updates. They're running sort of operational applications that are in the same boat. They're maybe, for many reasons, they can't get away from, can't secure, et cetera, et cetera. So I suppose, like Brad, technically, yes. And then when it comes to the reality of the spend that it takes to do that and the ability for a business to operate, then it starts to veer more into no. Or just by filing cabinets and paper, you know, either or.
And I guess just to wrap that one up, I don't know if you guys know where is Macquarie Health at the moment? Have they been able to restore things, get back online? What's the next steps for them?
What I read was that they had disconnected systems, but I guess I'm not sure if they're fully online yet. I'd to be honest, I guess that they're probably not. Like, it usually takes these group organizations a few days to recover. I think more concerningly, or what we don't know is, you know, if there is information out there, which is very common in terms of Hive and how they operate. If there's going to be information published as well, or even if Hive have access to it. But I would say, at least from a ongoing attack perspective, it looks like they are recovering at the very least.
Yeah, the old double exploitation, hey? So start to publish the data as well. So yes, it doesn't end just at the first hack, that's for sure.
Yeah, and could this be triple, you know, given that they have data on people that I presume is probably fairly sensitive? Like, do they go for the triple where they contact, you know, those people directly and say, hey, you know, give us some money, or we're going
to... They don't even have to, though. They can open credit cards and people's names. They can open bank accounts, like, from a whole fraud ecosystem perspective. Like, even if they don't do that, like, yeah, they can sell their details. Yeah. I mean, they can do four things.
Scary stuff indeed. Having a look at the New South Wales government have looked to extend the DMARC protocol for all of their LGAs, as we've come to know them, or local government areas across the state. Before we dive in, tell us what DMARC is.
DMARC is basically, it stands for Domain-Based Message Authentication Reporting and Conformance. What DMARC does is basically fix some of the kind of technical issues with SPF and DKIM, which let's probably not get down that rabbit hole. I realize this could keep going forever. Sender policy framework and the main key integrity. I can't even remember what DKIM stands for. Long story short, this is a way to start locking down sending services to your infrastructure. So, Dan, imagine if you're an organization, you know, you're acme.com, and you've got a SaaS provider that's abc.com, and they do sort of EDMs or marketing material for you, right? You want them to be able to send messages from your domain, and you want them to be able to do that legitimately. But you don't want hacker.com to be able to do that, for kind of bad reasons. Using DNS, so that's the kind of, you know, the phone book of the internet, as people describe it. So using that, which in theory is in control of an organization, so an LGA, what you can do is put a record in your DNS and tell organizations what to do if DMARC doesn't pass. So, you know, when I say DMARC passes, it means that when I see an email come through, I can look at the domain, I can go to the DNS record and make sure that the sender, for want of a better expression, is like okay to be sending from that domain. And there's a bunch of other things in the background around sort of IP address checks and envelope and header addresses and, you know, like, yeah, probably beyond the interest of our audience to get into it. But the outcome is that you end up with a situation where, in theory, you can lock down your sending services so that if you get an email using your domain, you know that it's not an attacker spoofing you, if that makes sense. So, yep. you know, abc.com or momcast.com, for example, you can be sure that if you see an email from that exact domain, you get to go. Going to call out the biggest problem with DMARC is that it's incredibly good for the domains you own. It does absolutely nothing for the domains you don't own. So any cousin domains, homoglyph, homograph attacks, any of that sort of stuff, forget about it. DMARC does nothing. But it's an excellent, excellent first thing to do.
Indeed. And if this gets rolled out like across the state, you know, what do we think, you know, what do we expect, you know, the positive sort of outcome to be from this?
Well, you know, if you're a council and you're getting emails, you can be sure that if you see the domains that are being protected by DMARC, then, you know, that eliminates a lot of spoofing attacks. So, you know, and that could be anything. That could be inbound phishing attacks. It could be social engineering, BEC type stuff. It could be lots of different things. So, you know, it's another incremental control. It's a really positive thing, you know, and it gets more powerful as more organizations do it, which is an important part of this. So it's great to see that the government is pushing it as they did in the US and in other countries. Like, this isn't just an Australian thing. It's a good thing to do for security.
Mm. I guess just to unpack the news a little bit more in terms of what it looks like the New South Wales government is doing. So it almost looks like a little bit of back and to and fro. So like, a couple of years ago in 2018, the councils were kind of saying there wasn't enough support from the state government as a result of an audit. And then kind of, I guess, as a reaction to this, there was a huge round of funding that was injected into this, by Cybersecurity New South Wales. And then that funding has now flowed down in terms of direct support for helping local councils provide or get to DMARC peoples reject. I'm not sure if there's a peoples reject in there. But it also is including things like training to local councils around cybersecurity as well. So I think this is fantastic. LGAs, they've been, to your point earlier, Dan, they've been instrumental, I think, during COVID and really the past kind of 2 years, and they will continue to be incredibly important in the future. And I think just as, you know, somebody, you know, ratepayer and stuff like that, to know that my bills and stuff are going to be signed with DMARC and kind of communications from them, I think it's a fantastic thing. So as to Gar's point as well, the more people that do it, it becomes even better as well. So there's also, I think, a conversation around BIMI records or BIMI records, which have definitely started to have with a few people. And that's the whole idea of where you can start to have a logo or a brand only if you're at Peoples Reject or 100% quarantine. And I think that's going to also help unlock this, probably a lot for marketers and, you know, kind of the area you're in, Dan, as well. But also just from a security perspective, where it's kind of another reason why you would enforce something, where really the problem with email is that it was never designed with any security in place. And, you know, that's the challenge today.
Like so much of the stuff we use, hey, like that's the problem. If it was ever designed with security, half of what we do today, we wouldn't actually do. I think it was with you guys, we were kind of joking about, the CHIPS program was the cyber hygiene improvement program. That was the ones who pushed this. And I just think Poncherello every time on a cool motorbike, pushing DMARC, like making cyber safe, making the world safe for all of us.
Indeed. And continuing on the government theme, last week we saw the announcement from the federal government on the ransomware action plan. And at the heart of it being around mandatory reporting around ransomware. But can you give us a bit more insights into what the ransomware action plan is addressing, and for us to sort of really unpack, you know, its impact and the way it will help organisations across Australia?
Yeah, this is a kind of hot potato topic, right? It's there's been a few kind of MPs on the other side, you know, talking about this, and I think it's a good thing fundamentally. I think many of the cybersecurity, you know, folks out there nationally in Australia, but I would say globally, are looking at this sort of legislation and regulation as a way to start to close the vice a little bit, at least in one area when it comes to ransomware. Home Affairs Minister Karen Andrews has kind of put forward this ransomware plan that kind of includes a mandatory reporting requirement. Now, the interesting thing is that it's for companies with a turnover of 10 million or more a year. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but I think you did the math on this one and figured out what percentage of organizations that actually is, and it's pretty small, right?
Yeah, it's actually just under 2% of Australian organizations turn over 10 million plus a year. So it's a very small pool out of everything that's happening from a ransomware perspective and the attackers in the market.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's a really important data point, because if I'm honest, that really didn't click with me when I saw this, and I probably got a little bit more excited than I should have, which, you know, it's the story of my life, let's be honest. But it's a cool start. I think it's an important start. You know, the idea here is that ransomware is such a big issue that if you can't measure it, it's really hard to manage the problem, right? And the issue is that we see the stories, you know, we've talked about some of them today, hitting the news every single day. Australian companies getting absolutely slammed by ransomware, and money's getting paid, right? That's the reality in the background. Money's getting paid to criminals. And there's some really interesting kind of ethical and legal questions there that I don't really fully understand. I'm not a lawyer, but there are other areas where, you know, there's a sort of obligation to report crime. And I'm kind of scratching my head again. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't really understand this stuff, but I don't really understand how an organization can make what is, I assume, an illegal payment to an illegal organization, which in my mind is kind of like, it at least involves crime, and then not have to sort of make that payment, first of all, known. And ideally the amount going out as well. Anyway, long, you know, probably gone on too long already, but you know, what this gives is sort of an insight, at least into, for that, you know, those organizations with a turnover of more than 10 mil, what's getting paid? And at least we can start to create some sort of data sets around, first of all, the volume of payments in terms of overall number. So we'll get some sort of proxy number for the number of attacks. And then secondly, you'll get the actual dollar amount, which could be, I mean, who knows, right? It's finger in the air stuff at the moment. I would like to see it expanded. I mean, that's a personal opinion. I think if there's ways we can anonymize and make sure that companies, I think this is an important point, right? Companies need to feel safe with doing the reporting, because what you don't want is having this problem pushed down underground where, because of a mandatory reporting requirement, that has implications. You know, clearly that has implications. And what you would hate to see is that instead of, reporting, people start kind of going underground, and you know, there's a bunch of incentives here that could play against what we want as an outcome, which is less ransomware. And I think that's the devil's in the detail. And I think there's a bunch of work still to be done and kind of industry consultation to figure out things like, what's the expected amount of time before you report? How do you anonymize the data? You know, what does the ACSD do with it? Like, there's a bunch of questions that I think aren't really answered yet, but I think it's a really good start.
It'll be interesting to see how closely we follow America. So I believe we're probably actually a little bit ahead of them in terms of their requirements around ransomware payments, because I know over there the Senate's debating. If you're critical infrastructure over there, I think you have the one, so you have 24 hours to report if you've made a ransomware payment. And then if you've been subjected to a cybersecurity incident, you have 72 hours to notify. And that's only applying to critical infrastructure. And I'm not sure exactly what critical infrastructure is defined as over in the US, because I know over here, when we're looking at our critical infrastructure kind of laws and stuff, there's a big discussion point there. But I think to your point, guys, like, organizations need to report the stuff. It needs to be visible. I believe, from my understanding, I think to a large degree, it is potentially illegal to pay a ransom in Australia. But I would also argue that in any circumstance where you could, you know, you're delivering a service or, you know, if you're like an electricity company, as an example, or a gas company, and somebody could die because you can't deliver them electricity, whatever it may be, like, I don't believe you'd ever be prosecuted for it. I don't think any company ever has really been prosecuted for paying a ransom in Australia.
I mean, getting back to the point of that only 2% of the affected population, if you like, is my challenge with this. So, like you say, it's a great first step, and we want visibility around the size of the problem and understand what that is. But from our own research at Mimecast, we know that nearly 65% of organisations said they suffered a ransomware attack in the last 12 months. So if it's so prevalent across industry, yet we're only reporting around a very small part, I feel there is the analogy to sort of the vaccine rollout, right? It's like, you know, we've just created, you know, a double vax immune for 2% of the population, but that doesn't make us feel good. That doesn't allow everyone else to actually want to actually be having that, engaging in that and actually being part of it. So it does need to expand beyond that. And so much of the commentary beneath it talks about SMBs and where it needs to be and how we need to support them. Yet then the focus becomes on, you know, reporting for a very small, large end of town or director's duties for large organizations and those sort of things. So we're not getting the follow through, I think, of the next step of what is the role of government, industry and sort of tertiary institutions to come together to start to solve and make a better cyber health program for the country and for SMBs. And I know we spoke about it last time, and this is going to be my hobby horse until we ever see something, because it just feels as though otherwise we're at a very superficial level of dealing with it, and we're not actually getting underneath and also not providing support. And I think one of the things that we speak about and look at in this is that mandatory reporting is at the back end. It's already happened. The bad stuff's happened. So the damage in many ways has been done. How do we stop it from happening? How do you get preventative in this and put the guardrails up ahead of time and make that accessible for the community abroad? So I feel like, yeah, it's a good first step, but feel like it's a little bit light on for where we need to be to actually address this problem across the country.
Yep, absolutely agreed. It's funny. There's an old show. I think it's old, called Utopia, which ABC did.
Yeah.
But as you're describing that, Dan, it just feels like they're, you know, the value of a, you know, a launch message versus the actual getting the project done. It feels a little bit like that sometimes. And I think you're spot on. You know, there's probably hard and difficult work to do, but we sort of need to do it, right? The results of that kind of work, I think, would be great for Australia as a country, but, you know, economically, clearly there'd be benefits.
Yeah, no, it definitely feels, unfortunately, a little bit of politics at play, right? And it is like, it is the show and the front end and what that looks like. But what is that substance and the program that actually sits behind it that will actually change things, right? I think we're a little while away from seeing what that is, and hopefully it starts to, you know, this is a step to building that momentum.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, thank you, Brad and Gar. Appreciate your insights as always. Gar, who have you got lined up for us as our special guest for next week's episode?
So next week is actually a very cool episode. I got a recommendation when I was at Ozcert for Dr. Chase Cunningham. So he's basically a retired Navy chief cryptologist. He's a guy who's kind of was buried in cyber forensic analytical operations. He's worked for a bunch of the three-letter organizations doing the kind of secret squirrel work. Just an absolute gun when it comes to this stuff. But he's also an author. He's written a book called Cyber Warfare, Truth, Tactics, and Strategies, which I actually think I recommend it to you guys. It's a really good read. Covers a bunch of broad topics, just super easy to read, but really kind of there's meat on those bones, if that makes sense. He goes into some cool stuff around machine learning and AI. So he's written that. And also a book called Gabriel, which he's actually just launched, which is fiction. But very kind of cool. It's a fiction book based in the world of cyber. So look, we get into a bunch of different things. I was originally keen to talk to him because he does forensics and I think it's something, it's important, but it's amazing how little we talk about, you know, what does it mean? How do you do it well? What's the point where you need to bring in the government or an external organization? So, you know, we have that conversation. Chase also did a PhD on some very cool stuff that to me sounded like Minority Report. I'm guessing you guys have seen that movie where you kind of predict what people are doing. Yeah, he did a bunch of research in that and kind of modeled human behavior and then kind of cross-correlated those with kind of technical precursors and indicators so that you could sort of see before people did the bad thing that they were going to do the bad thing. I find that stuff really quite fascinating. And then, you know, we talk about cyber warfare, AI, ML. He's got a fairly strong kind of set of opinions on that. But yeah, just a very, very interesting guy. And I think we barely touched the sort of surface of what he could and does know. So he may be a repeat guest. We'll see.
Oh, terrific. Looking forward to having our very own Cyber 007 on the show for next week. Well, that brings this week's episode to a close. If you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump on to getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the hottest articles, including a follow-up to the healthcare sector article from Brad with the adoption of how healthcare cloud services are on the rise, but buyers need to beware. Insights from Nick Lennon on why CISOs shouldn't reveal everything to the board, and an overview of how to cut through cybersecurity's marketing spin from yours truly. So thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.